White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. Boy, I've got that sound up a little bit too high there, man. I better get it down a little bit. So bear with me there, boys and girls. And we'll get it down here so it don't blast you. Terrible Tommy here. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling here, North Central Indiana, on a freezy day. Hey, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. If you don't have your donations in for the radio show at this time, get them in there, baby. Appreciate it. You can get them in right up to the end of the month, but then you got another next month to work on. Yeah. Send your moolah, your shekels, your pounds, your Swiss francs, your all that kind of stuff, or your, what do they call that new kind of funny money? Yeah. Hey, this is Freya's Day. This is Ladies' Day. This is She-Wolf Day in the bunker. We're going to play you at least one song, maybe two, because I get all excited when I play country music. I like outlaw country music. So sit back and relax and listen to old Terrible Tommy's music collection here. Yeah, just, I got to figure out what I'm doing here. There I go.
A long time forgotten, the dreams of this fell by the way. A good life he promised ain't what she's living today. But she never complains of the bad times or the bad things he's done, Lord. She just talks about the good times they've had and all the good times to come. She's a good-hearted
I forgot to plug my mic in. I was yapping away and nothing happening. Let's do one more here with the man in black, Johnny Cash.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Johnny Cash. songs as living things of the heart and mind, out of love, fun, grief. These are the words of Carl Sandburg, whose feelings for America and its people serve as inspiration for our program this evening. Tonight we're going to use his words to help us bring to you some of the songs of our great heritage. Carl Sandburg's poetry reached everyone, especially the workers. Or, as he said it, coal passers, taxi drivers, window washers, paper hangers, floor walkers, bill collectors, booze runners, hat cleaners, delicatessen clerks, shovel stiffs, and work plugs. It is wisdom to think the people are the city. And it is wisdom to think, no to hear it all until the working men, till the laughing men came. Bring a drink of water, Leroy. Bring a drink of water.
No.
If I could get to the Mercy Man, he'd give me some, I know. I got a gal in Vicksburg, Bertha is her name. I wish I was tied to Bertha instead of this ball and chain. I'm going to Memphis. Yeah. A dude took all my money. He wouldn't let me see the cars. I owe the boss about 100 years for sleeping in his backyard. I'm going to Memphis.
Yes, right.
Like a bitter weed, I'm a bad seed. But when that levee's through, and I am too, let the honky-tonk roll on. Come on and I'll be gone. I'm going to Memphis.
Going to Memphis.
Yeah. I've never been to Chicago, but it must be a mighty fine place. I couldn't get past Tennessee with Mississippi all over my face. I'm going to Memphis.
Yeah, going to Memphis.
Well, the freezing ground at night is my own folding bed. Poke salad is my bread and meat, and it will be till I'm dead. Another boy's gone down, the shovel burned him out. Let me stand on his body to see what the shouting's about. I'm going to Memphis, yeah. Like a bitter weed, I'm a bad seed. But when that levee's through, and I am too, let the honky-tonk roll on. Come on and I'll be gone. I'm going to Memphis, yeah, I'm going to Memphis.
Jackson.
If I could.
Well, when I breeze in.
There you go. That's for all the she-wolves out there. And, you know, once I get on that country, that outlaw country, I just can't leave it go. So, sorry if I ran over time there, but I love that music. Now let's get down to business. Get down to business. I want to have you hear this book report I picked up in the middle of the night on how democracy is a bunch of crap. This guy lays it out pretty well.
A Georgetown University political philosopher with a brand new book out. It's called Against Democracy. Jason, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Vulcan Smirkanish, reporting for duty, sir.
How are you?
How do we limit the, well, let's define them. The hobbits, the hooligans, and the Vulcans. Now, keep in mind, this is a pretty sophisticated radio audience you're receiving. We all think we are Vulcans, but explain who the hobbits, hooligans, and Vulcans are.
Sure. So hobbits are, if you think of the Lord of the Rings, people, these short people who don't really care much about the outside world and just want to sort of eat their breakfast. The political analog of that would be someone who doesn't have a strong ideology, doesn't know much about politics, and just doesn't participate much. A hooligan, if you think about how soccer hooligans operate, would be someone who has a lot of information but is incredibly biased towards their own side, only looks for information that reaffirms their current beliefs, and tends to view members of the other side as stupid and evil and their own enemies. And finally, Vulcans are kind of ideal type of a perfectly rational agent who only believes what the evidence requires and has no fidelity to their own worldview and is willing to give up their ideas as soon as new evidence comes in. And, you know, lots of hooligans always think that they're Vulcans, but they're generally hooligans.
Is it an intelligence thing? Are the hobbits and the hooligans necessarily less intelligent than the Vulcans, or is it that they are engaged or not engaged in a different way?
No, it's really more about interest. The biggest predictor that you participate heavily in politics and that you know a lot about it is that you're interested in it. Unfortunately, though, that comes with the tendency for people to be incredibly biased. So interest predicts that you have an ideology and you'll just look to reaffirm it over and over again, and you'll be antagonistic towards others. IQ, education by itself and so on are heavily limited effects on political behavior.
You say that you could have filled the entire book on how little voters know. And by the way, you obviously went to press on this before the outcome of the most recent election. Give some examples of just how little the American people as a whole know.
So for 65 years, we've been studying voter knowledge, and the results have been depressing for 65 years. People generally know who the president is and not much else. They can't estimate the unemployment rate within 5 percentage points. They generally don't know which party controls Congress. They can't find their congressperson if you give them a multiple choice test off a list. They don't know what's happened recently, any recent facts. Take the 2000 U.S. election. Slightly more than half of Americans knew that Gore was more liberal than Bush, but if you gave them follow-up questions such as who supports abortion rights, who's more in favor of doing things to help blacks and minorities, who's more pugilistic when it comes to war, who wants to expand the government more, and so on, they didn't know the answers to those questions. So it seems like they didn't even know what the word meant.
So this is Jason Brennan, and the new book is titled Against Democracy. Jason, I imagine some are listening to this conversation and saying, well, obviously, more participation is the answer.
Well, if only it worked. You know, that's what a lot of people have been hoping for, is if we can just get people to participate more, it will improve them. And the model that they have in mind is how Vulcans would participate with one another. Vulcans, being perfectly rational, if they talk to each other, would realize that there's information that they're missing and would change their beliefs accordingly. In fact, when we measure how people participate, what we find is that usually getting them to talk to people that they disagree with actually causes them to become more ossified and solid in their own beliefs, to become angry, to often come to fight with one another. As Diana Mutz, a political scientist at Penn, found out, that the people who participate most in politics are also the ones that tend to be the most ideological. So if I ask you, hey, you're a Democrat, why would anyone vote Republican? And you answer, because they're stupid and evil. That predicts that you vote frequently and often and that you participate in many things. If you actually are able to explain the other side in a way the other side finds appealing, that predicts you don't vote and you don't participate.
There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that 45% of those eligible did not vote on November 8th in our presidential election. And naturally, what you hear as part of that conversation, oh, we need to get more people to vote. But having read your book, that's not necessarily the outcome that would produce a better result.
Yeah, the worry here is, politics depends upon information. Politicians are running on policy platforms, and they shape their platforms to appeal to what they think the median voter wants. So they're basically placing a bet on what people will vote for, and to some degree they try to implement these things. So what people want depends on what they know. We can test that. We found out that information by itself changes how people think about politics. And when you look at the people who choose to vote versus the people who stay home, the people who choose to vote are much better informed than the people who stay home. Now, they're not very well informed at all, but the average, the median voter, the modal voter, the typical voter knows very little about politics, but the people who don't participate know even less.
Well, they might be informed. I mean, the people you're referring, the hooligans might be informed, but informed within their respective bubble, mm-hmm. which could be NPR and Huffington Post and MSNBC, or it could be the Drudge Report and Breitbart and Fox News and the AM version of talk radio. Is that necessarily being informed? Well, that's a debatable matter.
Sure, I think you're right about that. I like to say the democracy is the rule of hobbits and hooligans. We have biased people who know a little bit about politics and less biased people who know basically nothing. But the worry here is even when you look within political parties, you find that high and low information voters within a given party have different political beliefs. So on both sides of the aisle, both Republicans and Democrats, very high information voters tend to prefer one set of policies. They tend to agree with each other about policies. For example, they tend to be pro-free trade and pro-immigration and less warlike, and low-information voters, regardless of which party they belong to, tend to be anti-free trade, very protectionist, anti-immigration, and very pugilistic. So, sure, there's bias, and that makes things worse, but even then, the information does change what we believe in certain ways.
All right, Vulcans unite. How are we going to take this over?
Well, people often think I'm advocating the rule of Vulcans, and in a sense, I would if there only there were any, but aside from, my friends and me and your listeners, there just aren't that many of us. So I think one possibility would be, this is the really dramatic thing that a lot of people would attack, is what if you were advocating alternatives to democracy, one man, one vote, where you actually require people to, say, pass a test of basic knowledge, or if you pass the test of basic knowledge, you acquired additional votes. These things are probably unconstitutional. It takes a lot to argue for them. But even if you just had imagine the government has something called a voter achievement exam. A week before the election takes place, you go and you take a test, and if you pass the test, you get a $1,000 tax credit. If you do pretty well, you get a $500 tax credit. This would incentivize people to be more informed, and it's legal and acceptable within our own framework.
Look, you've got to take a test to operate a motor vehicle.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason that we require that is because we recognize that when you're operating a motor vehicle, you're not just getting freedom for yourself, but you're also imposing serious risks upon others. Why not say the same thing about voting? The big difference here is that I, as an individual driver, can do a lot of harm, whereas individual voters do no harm. But that's actually the problem in the first place. The reason voters are so badly informed isn't because they're stupid. It's not because they're mean. It's because the incentives are wrong. In a democracy, you spread out power so widely that the average person basically doesn't have any power, so they don't get rewarded for using power wisely. They don't get punished for using it badly. But the result is that everyone thinks the same way. It's as if we're having imagine having a college test, and the professor says, in 3 months, I have 1,000 people in my class. In 3 months, we're all taking a final exam, I'm going to average all of your grades together. So you don't get your own grade. You get the average class grade. Well, if a professor did that, you get an average class grade of an F, and that's effectively what's happening in democracy.
Okay, so I'm playing along with you. I'm trying to create the epistocracy that you envision, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're the political philosopher, so I will ask you this. Do we necessarily need to represent equally all demographics? And if so, how are we going to do that?
Sure. So it's true that a good government is going to be one that represents the interests of everyone who's involved. It doesn't follow, though, as a matter of logic, that the way you represent the interests of everyone involved is by asking them what they want. And the reason here is because think of this. Imagine I could wave. This is what I often ask students when I'm at very left-wing universities. I'll say, imagine I can wave a magic wand and I'll make all black people vote, but they'll all vote for Trump. Would you like me to wave the magic wand? And they say, no, of course not. And I go, okay, so you agree with me here on one point, which is that it's not enough simply that you vote. You actually have to vote for things that help you rather than hurt you. So it depends. You might think there's a difference between what you might call your outcome preferences, the stuff that you want to happen, like better employment, better job opportunities, less crime, and your policy preferences, the mechanisms, the tools, the laws and rules that by which you want to create those things. So voters, they might know a lot about what outcomes they want, and they might be pretty reasonable about that, but to know what policies to vote for requires tremendous knowledge of basic facts plus tremendous social scientific knowledge, which unfortunately they lack. So the question really here is, which kinds of representative government are going to best actually promote people's interests rather than just simply asking people what they want?
Well, I would argue that as a true Vulcan, I know what's in people's best interest, whether they know so or not. And therefore, I can represent non-middle-aged, bald, white guys, which is what I happen to be.
Well, you know, of course, we're all biased in various ways, and we're all lacking in information. So the question really here is just, given how biased everyone is, what's the sort of optimal way of dealing with our biases? The nice thing, though, is people actually do try to vote altruistically. Most voters do not vote selfishly. It's kind of a myth that they vote their pocketbooks. And the reason they vote altruistically is because their votes matter so little, it doesn't really make sense to be a selfish voter. If you're selfish, you might as well stay home and play video games rather than vote in the first place. The question just here is, like, what do they know? What is their ideology, and how likely is it to be tracking the truth? Unfortunately, we find that a large segment of the population, say, subscribes to just economic beliefs that were refuted 200 years ago and no economist left or right agrees with. So take, you know, we had a lot of talk about protectionism in the current election. No economist left-wing or right-wing agrees with protectionism. It's just a settled matter. But nevertheless, the average American believes in economic philosophy that Adam Smith refuted in 1776.
Hey, Jason, I thoroughly enjoyed Against Democracy. It made me ponder some issues that I hadn't thought of previously. But is it all for shits and giggles that you wrote it, or is there something tangible that you hope will come out of this?
It's not just for shits and giggles. I am a contrarian at heart, and I often write about those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, I think we view politics as a kind of sacred endeavor, and our tendency to think of it as sacred is undermining politics itself, is preventing us from producing better policies. So I think the problem of political ignorance is really damaging democracy, and it's time that we admit that there's a problem and try to take steps to rectify it. And we're not going to be able to do that so long as we continue to think democracy is sacred. So I'm trying to convince people that democracy is just a
camera. Give me something. Give me something tangible.
Something we could do is stop asking people to just vote no matter what. If we change the culture from you should vote regardless of whether you know anything to what it is to be responsible is to be an informed voter, that could change things for the better.
Come out and vote so long as you're knowledgeable.
Yeah, first inform yourself, then vote, rather than vote no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Congratulations on the book. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Really appreciate that.
Tom, which asks, would you like to live in an epistocracy? The rule of knowers, where decision-making is restricted to those more knowledgeable and less biased. Call me on that.
Now, I think that book is probably equivalent to about 4 years of sociology study. He knows the score, and you see, the masses don't really want to take time to vote. They want somebody else to make the decision. Now, they'll lie to you and tell you, no, I want my opinion to run things. Well, they do. But that's why democracy is a sham, because, number one, there's no pure democracy around and never has been, and even the original one collapsed shortly after it was invented. Those crazy Greeks. Anyhow, you know, I never went to college except for I took a city college course at Santa Monica City College in Los Angeles in history. But, you know, studying that stuff is like studying a road map without seeing the trees and the beautiful mountains along the way. Yeah, that's the trouble with history. That's why I don't like history. I do like true history, but I don't like just quoting events. I want to know more about the underlying reasons for things. But anyhow, this guy wrote a good book, and as I've told you before, I I don't perceive myself as right or left anymore. I only perceive myself as looking for answers to problems that may affect the white race. And so when you hear things on this radio show, you're lone wolves, you're supposed to be lone thinkers and think it over and decide what you think about it. Not just to take it carte blanche, because this is just my opinion and other people's opinion that I get off the internet. So it's not something that's absolute. And so now a real right-winger or left-winger, they're going to say, did you hear what he said? Well, he's a goddamn Nazi. Or do you hear what he said? Well, he's a goddamn Marxist, you know. So, but that's not the way I think. I think about going to the, to get the correct information, no matter where I get it. And so you have to discern it and pick through it, what I tell you or what I run by you, and decide how much of it is good, how much of it is bad, and how much of it's in the middle of the road. Because I send you stuff, but not all of it I agree with, of course, but that's the name of the game. But this guy is totally correct. I mean, people are not only informed, less informed, but they're stupid in most cases. At election time, they all get brilliant. Everybody's a genius. They all know all the answers. And when I try to talk to them or talk to them, they're absolutely sure of everything. So I don't waste my time talking to them. But a month after the election, they're back to their normal position of not knowing a damn thing. And they really don't know it either when they go to vote, because they're victims of the information that they get, and then victims of their inability to evaluate information. So, democracy, a sham. Republic, nah, not so bad. Constitutional monarchy, nah, not so bad. But dictators are more efficient. Let me put it that way. A dictator that's wise, knows what he's doing, is much more effective than a Democrat or a democracy. So, but the problem is a dictator is one person with a collection of guys around him, and he can turn on a dime. He could turn on a dime for good for you or terrible for you. And at least the republic and sham democracy is like a big giant naval ship. It takes it a while to turn around. Maybe in the meantime you can think about it and maybe say, I don't think we should turn around. But with a dictator, he's going to change overnight, and it may be your head that's chopped off. If you observe, if you ever read the history of the French Revolution, that's the way that went. You had all these conspirators, but then once they got the revolution accomplished and cut the heads off of the king and queen, they started working on each other. And finally, every one of the revolutionaries had their heads chopped off. Right down to Dante, who really was the guy that masterminded the revolution. Of course, there was Marat. He was a real son of a bitch too. But like the way they took care of Marat, his chambermaid or whatever the hell she was, cook, bottle washer, or whatever, stuck a knife in him or blasted him with a gun. Marat, he was even more evil than Dante. But the odd part of the French Revolution was that the king was becoming far more liberal. He was going the way that they wanted, but he was going too slow, I guess. I'm surely not opposed to revolutions. as long as they go the right way and don't become worse than what you're replacing. The revolution in France, at least for a while until Napoleon took over, was going a bad way, man. It was worse than the King Louis. But then Napoleon came along and straightened it all out for a while. And from what I can gather, Napoleon was a pretty good leader, really. One thing I didn't agree with, he initiated conscription of the common man to fight in the army. Before that, it was the blue bloods that fought in the wars. But Napoleon started drafting people along the road, a peasant. Hey, come with me. We're going to fight a war. Shit, I don't want to fight a war. Get in a goddamn line. Now, if you want to hear how far the right wing has gone to placate the Untermenschen, the non-whites, listen to this. It was off right wing radio. Now, Dylan Roof did an act, killed 9 people in a church. Shouldn't make any difference whether they were in a church or not. Shouldn't make any difference whether they're black or not, because there were people. He killed 9 people. But unlike with the blacks, they'll go on and on and write books and make movies about what drove him to do it. They're not going to do that, like they do for the blacks when they kill white people terribly and torture them and everything else, and the rape and the raping 100-year-old women and stuff like that. They say, oh, that's not too good, and then they go on and they write 16 books about how these people were driven to it. But they won't do that for Dylan Roof, because he was driven to it by something, by somebody, by something he read or something he saw, and it built up into him to where he just had to do something, or he really didn't have to do it, but he did something, and everybody goes, whoa, this is horrible. But it's interesting the way the right wing has gone totally overboard to placate the non-whites. Listen to this.
So much is, there really isn't much to debate. Guy is guilty as hell and should die. And I'm not saying that because, well, Andrew, you conservatives have to ingratiate yourself with a black audience. It's that, what is there to debate here? If you notice, most of the topics we discuss on this program are steeped in debate and mechanics. I mean, it's pretty obvious to everyone this guy is guilty. He's a monster. He's a terrorist. And he should die a terrorist's death. Now, you want to make that a vat of acid, a running wood chipper, firing squad, hanging? Have at it. I really don't care. But if you've been asking yourself, why hasn't Andrew been talking about Dylan Roof? Because there really isn't anything to debate. Why is it 695 Patriot 9?
Hell, now I forget whether I ran the clip or not, and then I've erased the clip. That's it. Come on, man, get with it. Anyhow, in the Dylan and Ruth case, they have not gone over his manifesto, and they probably not cover what he's going to say in defending himself. And there's many other ways that these conservative right-wing chicken shit bastards will fail to point out that he had any cause at all. And they all want to execute him. So I don't hear the blacks doing things like that. How many blacks get on radio and TV after one of their people have murdered a bunch of people, white people, and raped and pillaged? You don't hear that. And the whites are always trying to figure out, oh, why did they do it? Oh, why did he do it? And Jesus still loves him, you know? Right. You know, reading this antebellum book by Rowan Helper, very interesting, because people in this country think that just because we broke ties with the King of England that we escaped economic dictatorship. The mercantile system was still well in force and has determined what the United States is today racially, because without taking the Negroes out of the country and taking them back to Africa or wherever, it's like a nuclear power plant that goes bad, that you don't have it making power anymore, but it's gonna, but the damage is there, and you got to clean it up. Well, we had the nuclear situation with the Negroes in the South on the plantation system, and stopped that. But the economic systems in power didn't follow through and clean it up. You know, they left the toxic material there, and the toxic material has been spreading ever since. So, and also the fact that the economic interests of cotton and sugar wanted to keep the South agrarian. I mean, not agrarian with small farmers and so forth, like in Tennessee and the Highlands. They wanted to keep it like it was, and to serve their purposes so that they could have their cotton over in England and so forth like that. Something that happens all over, even today, that the mercantile system of now, the crony capitalists, dirty the earth and cause all kinds of damage, and then they leave, like the fracking out west. They drilled hundreds of wells out there in, I think it was Colorado, but they have in Oklahoma and all over the place. But when they leave, they don't clean anything up. They don't put it straight. That's one of the big sins of capitalism. They know how to make money. They know how to get the oil out of the ground. They know how to do all this stuff, but they don't know how to clean up, or they won't clean up. They're doing it all over Africa now. So you can thank the elite, the ruling class, mostly whites and Jews and a few others, for creating most of the problems in the world. And these are going to come around and bite us in the ass. They're biting us in the ass right now, even weather change. So who's your enemy? Who really is your enemy? The average white person doesn't know how to identify the enemy, doesn't have a clue, or makes excuses for them, you know. And everybody out there that wants to take care of the Negro problem, which is just one of the problems, they just don't understand. Until you take care of the people at the top, the ruling class, and the crony capitalists and predatory capitalism, which contains most of those people, you're never gonna change the Negro problem. So, like Dylann Roof, he wanted to solve the Negro problem, but he wanted to start at the bottom. And that's what everybody that's ever committed murder and crimes against black people in this country have not realized. They didn't cause it. I mean, it's not their thing. And so people who say, well, I'm going to change the problem, I'm going to do something for white people, go out and kill black person standing on the corner, just don't get it. But the right wing causes that too. The right wing conservatives really cause that kind of a problem, and a lot of the racial right, because they don't talk that much, a lot of them, about who's really the problem, and equate it down to what the black race does. So Dylann Roof could have been salvaged if he'd have talked to the right people. But wherever he was getting his information from, and I'm sure he did, stressed it's just a black problem. And if you and so his assumption was, well, if I kill off black people, well, that'll solve the problem. But that is not solving the problem. Until you decide that your real enemy is the mercantile class at the top, the 1 or 2%, 3% of the people, population, who control the money and are the ruling class, you'll never get anywhere. So it's going to take a long time to get to that point. Maybe we never will, because our race is being educated stupidly more and more, downbred and the whole bit. So will it be enough? Will there be enough white people that know the score to change this thing? I don't know. It's doubtful. One thing for sure, if you cannot seize the centers of communication, the television broadcasting companies and so forth, and radio syndicates, and at least control half of what they're putting out, then it'll never change, because people are led by that hypnotic device, the television tube. One example of that is Oprah Winfrey. I mean, she made billions off white women that weren't at home doing anything and weren't really out in the workforce that much, that they began to worship Oprah Winfrey. Now, go back 100 years, or maybe not even that far, and ask people on the street, do you see yourself worshiping a fat black woman on some kind of a device we're going to get called television? And they say, you must be crazy, man. Get out of here. I'll kick your ass. Television has been used as a hypnotic device ever since it was invented. It wasn't invented for that purpose. It was good white people who developed, Farnsworth, who developed television. But every time anything comes along, it's always turned to the benefit of the ruling class, and usually in a negative way. Look at nuclear power. Back in the day when they were coming up with it, the first thing they used it for was murdering people. And they wanted to murder all the German people. Unfortunately for them, that the war ended before they could use it. So they said, well, we know how they feel about the Japanese, because a lot of their sons and daughters died at the hands of the Japanese, so we'll drop it on them. So rather than using the nuclear power for great peaceful uses, it immediately was used to murder people. Well, it looks like King Kong has decided to shadow box with Thor. King Kong being Obama, and Thor being Putin. You know, it's very stupid for a Neanderthal, not a Neanderthal, but a primate, to get in a fight with a Thor. They don't understand the Russians, and to their just like Hitler didn't understand the Russians. And so better be careful, Obanga. Better be careful. Well, now that it looks like there may be a win by Assad in Syria, what's the next way they're going to try to figure out to destroy him? Because they're not going to quit. They're not going to quit. This means they're going to get a lot more devious. Well, I see President-elect Donald Trump will nominate bankruptcy Jew David Friedman as U.S. ambassador to Israel. And Friedman said he looked forward to taking up this post in Jerusalem, a step that would reverse decades of U.S. foreign policy and spark rancor in the Muslim world. Well, that figures. The U.S. Embassy has been located in Tel Aviv for more than 68 years. Trump had pledged during the presidential campaign to move it to Jerusalem. Big mouth, a move almost certain to provoke objections from the Muslims around the world. Well, of course it will. Friedman has been a longtime friend and trusted advisor to me. His strong relations with Israel will form the foundation of his diplomatic mission and be a tremendous asset to our country as we strengthen the ties with our allies and strive for peace in the Middle East, Trump said in a statement. Of course, you know what that means, more kissing the ass of Israel. He is a bankruptcy attorney. Don't we love bankruptcy attorneys? The Republican made clear during his campaign that he would support Israel in a number of critical areas. Of course, including moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, all but enshrined the city as Israel's capital over international objections. He also pledged not to put pressure on Israel to engage in talks with Palestinians. So, Mr. Right-wingers out there, what are you gaining with this asshole? Huh? Yeah, he's already an asshole as far as I'm concerned. Sorry, right-wing Dukeites. The United States and other powers do not regard Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In addition to the U.S. Embassy, other nations' ambassadors are in embassies are in Tel Aviv and do not recognize Israel's annexation of the Arab East Jerusalem following its capture in the 67 Middle East War. One of the thorniest issues is resolving the rival Israel and Palestinian demands for Jerusalem's future. Palestinians regard the ancient city, which contains sites sacred to the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian fanatics, as the future capital of a separatist state. As long as you've got religion flying around, you're always going to have problems. Friedman, who specializes in litigation and bankruptcy law, well, maybe he can help figure out how they're going to plead bankruptcy here in this country. We'll need him here. He said in a statement that he would work tirelessly to strengthen the unbreakable bond between our two countries and advance the cause of peace within the region. Well, that's bullshit. You guys have never advanced the cause of peace in the region. And look forward to doing this from the U.S. Embassy in Israel's eternal capital of Jerusalem. Well, get out your flak jackets, boys, because if you're going to do that, you're going to have a shootout. You know that old battle axe, Aretha Franklin, is still trying to decide whether she'll sing at the inauguration. She don't know whether she can bring herself to do that. Well, don't do it, bitch. Let's hear the Beach Boys, huh? Or some outlaw country. That'll get you more ground. If it was up to me, I wouldn't invite any of these goddamn Hollywood singers. None of them. Absolutely none. The problem is that they're a bunch of spoiled brats, those liberal Hollywood people. Do you realize how many thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of white people are living on the street? And how many of those were kicked out of mental institutions by Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan? I mean, you know, we talk about a lot of other things about whites dying in battle and all that kind of stuff, but this is the real super tragedy, and I know the right wing doesn't give a shit, and that's why I'm not a right winger. Hundreds of thousands of white people, not only for economic means, but for mental health means. We can spend trillions on warfare, but we can't spend any money on mental treatment and so forth like that. Think about it. Well, that's it for Freya's Day and Friday, and I'll be back on Moon's Day to talk to you. I hope I can dig up some more trash and dirt and crap and racist stuff. I'll try real high, boys and girls. Bye-bye.